Hello, I'm Rosie Perez, and you're listening to Food Fridays with Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org.
Without immigrants, like the Germans, Italians, Eastern European Jews, Greeks, Irish, and Chinese, just to name a few, New York wouldn't be the famous food hub that we knew it to be today. Jane Ziegelman, director of the Tenement Museum's Culinary Center, author of 97 Orchard, an edible history of five immigrant families in one New York City tenement, and co-author of her latest, A Square Meal, a culinary history of the Great Depression, joins us to talk about the ongoing evolution of food in New York and what food can tell us about society and culture. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you, Melissa.
And listeners, I want you to all call in. Is there a food brought to New York by immigrants that you love but have trouble finding? Is there something about the Lower East Side food culture that you remember from your childhood or maybe someone in your family would talk about? If you want to talk about any of those topics, Jane wants to talk about them with you, so call in. The number here is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So, Jane, how do you see food as a useful perspective when talking about history? I mean, food is your lens, and you write about you write about culture through food. Talk about your work that way.
That's a big question.
I know, it's
but
a big question.
It's a really important one. I guess the idea is by looking at food, you sort of cut through a lot of the unnecessaries and the get right to the heart of the matter, because this is what people really care about, is when they're especially immigrants in a new place, is finding that sort of continuity through food to the culture they left behind, and then establishing a kind of new food economy in their adopted homeland. So it's a way to look at family relationships. It's a way to look at how people work and get jobs. It's a really good way to understand women's work and the role of women in the family. And it gets you, it's very intimate. It gets you really close to your historical subject. So you're sort of eye to eye at the table, you know, over a cup of soup.
Your work at the Tenement Museum, I mean, just talking about women's work and also talking about being intimate. You know, someone's home is a very intimate space. And when you're peeling back the layers of being in someone's home, I know that part of what the Tenement Museum does is you have many different immigrant groups in the same building. You have one building and you have all these different families that have traveled through it. And then you peel back the layers. What are some of the things that you find from group to group? You know, how has it changed from the beginning of the history of the building, let's say, to the latest? How far does it go? It goes from...
It really begins... the building went up in the 1860s. Right. I think it was 1863. And then it wasn't torn down, but it was shuttered. And I think that was in 1935. So it's basically from the 1860s to the 1930s. And what you see, first of all, very simply, is waves of different immigrants from different parts of the world. So the first really important immigrant wave on the Lower East Side were the Irish. And these were people who were coming over mostly in response to the great potato blight of the 1840s. Next in line, you have the Germans. And the Germans are really interesting to me because they represent a piece of the history of the Lower East Side that really isn't known about today. It's a sort of secret history.
Really? I mean, because do we think of Germans as Upper East Side? Is that why? Or what do you mean that they're not really?
Do you associate Germans with the Lower East Side?
German Jews, I guess. But
German
not...
Jews. Well, there were both German Jews and German Gentiles. And my theory about this is that with the coming of World War I and then eventually World War II, Germans became persona non grata.
I see.
And there was a not entirely conscious attempt to kind of wipe them out of the history books. And it's sad. They were very important people on the Lower East Side, and they really helped make the community what it was.
Do you think that some of it is because there was so much discrimination against them during the wars that they really assimilated more thoroughly, shall we say, in New York?
I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
And the other part of it, which is interesting, is that we have so thoroughly assimilated German foods that we don't really recognize them anymore as immigrant foods.
What are some of the lost dishes of the German Lower East Side that, you know, we can look for?
It's sort of the dishes that you might imagine, but in a kind of profusion that is far from what we know today. Mm-hmm. So wursts. It was the Lower East Side was a neighborhood of millions of wursts. Wursts in every color, wursts from veal, wursts from pork, wursts from Wiener wursts and schnitzel wursts and bratwursts. So I don't think that we sort of have that profusion anymore.
No, we don't. I don't think there's any... Yeah, I can't think of historic verse shops that you think of on the Lower East Side.
No, you don't. I mean, we have Schaller and Weber.
That's true, but that's
on the Upper East Side.
That's Upper East Side. Now, what about... Okay, so a listener wants to know, where's the best place to get a spinach knish? And then why don't we talk about knishes?
Sure.
Now, that's not... That wasn't German, though. That was...
No, that was Russian Jewish.
Okay.
I don't know why you would go anywhere else but Yonah Schimmel.
Is there anywhere else actually to even?
I really don't know it. And even if there were, why would you go?
Why would you go there?
Can go to Yonah Schimmel and watch the little elevator that, what is it called? The elevator that goes up and down.
Oh,
and
the dumbwaiter. Yeah.
And you can drink your cold buttermilk with your knish.
Spinach knishes there too?
I believe they do. I mean, they seem to have many knishes, and I can't see that they wouldn't have a spinach. So I would head straight for Yonah Schimmel.
My personal favorite is the kasha, though.
Kasha, yes.
Okay, so we have a caller on line 3 who wants to talk about Bialys. Would you like to talk about Bialys?
Yes, I would love to talk about Bialys.
Okay, so we have Ellen.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, Ellen. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Mayopac, New York,
okay.
Which is just north of Westchester in Putnam County.
Fantastic. So what would you like to say about Bialys?
Well, it used to be years ago that you could get really authentic Bialys at Kosar's, but they changed hands several times, and the recipes changed, and now they're much more like, of course, between an English muffin and a bagel than a traditional Bialy. And I was just wondering if your guest could talk about Bialys, and is there any chance of it getting back to sort of the original recipe, which I think used spelt flour or some other specialty flour?
I mean, spelt flour was I don't know. Is that true, actually, about the spelt flour?
The question is, were Bialys made from spelt flour?
Well, the question is, Bialys, Ellen was saying that, you know, they've changed a lot. They've become very English muffin-y.
Yes.
And it's hard to find a really good one. And maybe some of the earlier versions were made from spelt flour or other types of flour.
I've never heard the spelt Bialy connection.
Uh-huh.
But it is true that a lot of the bread products that landed on the Lower East Side, particularly that came from Eastern Europe, have sort of been they become Americanized in a way that's not to their benefit, in that bagels have become softer and puffier.
Yeah.
We all know that. And Bialys have become sort of less pungent and not quite as chewy. You don't have to really wrestle with your Bialy the way you used to. I do think that Kosar's is still the place to go for bagels on the Lower East Side. Yeah, for Bialys on the Lower East Side, exactly.
This is Melissa Clark. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Jane Ziegelman, director of the culinary program at the Tenement Museum in Manhattan. So we were just talking Bialys. We have some other callers. Oh, if people want to talk about pastrami. Would you like to talk about pastrami? So we have Moshe from Flushing. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. What would you like to know about pastrami?
Well, I'm a big fan of Jane's book, 97 Orchard, An Edible History of Five Immigrant Families in One New York Tenement. And it had a lot of fascinating information in it. And one of the things I was most surprised to learn from the book was that originally pastrami wasn't made with beef, but was made with goose.
Jewish
immigrants actually raised geese in the backyards of the tenements in order to make pastrami, which I find absolutely astonishing. So my question is sort of two parts. First is anybody making pastrami from goose now? I'd love to taste some. And if not, can we start a project maybe with the museum sponsorship to get some made?
Oh, my God, that's such a wonderful idea. You're absolutely correct, historically. Pastrami was a Romanian food, and it was made from goose breast. Like so many other foods from the Jewish delicatessen tradition, the basis of these foods was goose, because, of course, Jews were not eating pork-based meats. I haven't seen goose pastrami around. Have you, Melissa?
I've never seen goose pastrami, but, you know, I have seen, I've seen salmon pastrami. I've seen, which is a new thing. I know that's not historic.
Yeah, it's good, too.
I've seen cured duck breast, but no, I've never, and I think that is such a good idea. I mean, geese have such a high fat content.
Exactly.
So if you're going to substitute something for making salumi and curing, mm-hmm. you want something with a high fat content. So it makes perfect sense.
And actually, I know people that might be interested in this. So maybe we can make a little shidach.
Do you think we can get the Tenement Museum to give us a place to experiment?
Well, I can inquire.
I love that idea. So goose pastrami. We're talking with Jane Siegelman, who's from the New York City Tenement Museum. We're talking about Lower East Side food traditions. So why is the Lower East Side, as opposed to other neighborhoods in New York, especially interesting in terms of food and in terms of diversity of food?
Why is the Lower East Side so interesting? First of all, it is New York's most cosmopolitan dining neighborhood. And in a certain way, the way I see the history of the Lower East Side is that modern New York was really born on the Lower East Side. It gives us sort of the two conditions that are really most typical of modern New York, and that's diversity and density. So it's lots of activity squished into this small area with all kinds of people and creating this flourishing food scene. And there's a kind of critical mass there that's just extremely exciting. So that's one of the food attractions of the Lower East Side. The other food attraction for me is the kind of ghostiness of the neighborhood, the sense that you can feel that other people were here and that they've kind of moved on but left little reminders of themselves behind, like food shops, like DePaolo's.
Uh-huh.
Which is on Grand Street, I think, or...
Yeah, on Grand.
On Grand. Or like Russ and Daughters. You know, at one time, the Lower East Side was absolutely crawling with dairy restaurants and Italian cheese stores. Now, just these few sort of token reminders are there, but it's a kind of piece of the past sort of living into the future. And there's something very poignant about that for me.
I think that, you know, one thing that's interesting about food is that you have, so as you have different immigrant groups coming to the Lower East Side, you were talking about different types of assimilation or different depths of assimilation. But with food, you know, you still had these places that they stayed the same, even though the people who frequented them were assimilated in
yes.
different ways, but the food didn't change.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't think that Russ and Daughters, for example, has changed all that much since it opened, and that was 100 years ago. And it seems that some of the guys slicing the salmon are the same guys that have been there over all that time. There's a... What I've seen happening is that the sort of residents move on, but these iconic businesses remain, and they've kind of made a decision not to modernize. They want to be exactly sort of who they are, and I mean, with some adjustments to account for modern food sensibilities, but there's a real sort of commitment to the way things were. And now people come back to the neighborhood on sort of food pilgrimages. So we make food pilgrimages to Russ and Daughters on the holidays, or to a place like DePaolo's, where you know that you'll get the best mozzarella in town. So these places have become these sort of pilgrimage spots.
Let's talk more about food pilgrimages when we come back. We're talking about the foods of Manhattan's Lower East Side with Jane Siegelman. Jane is the director of the culinary program at the Tenement Museum. She's also the author of 97 Orchard, an edible history of 5 immigrant families in 1 New York tenement, and co-author of A Square Meal, a culinary history of the Great Depression. We'll hear more from her after the break. I've been speaking with Jane Ziegelman. She's the author of 97 Orchard, an edible history of five immigrant families in one New York tenement, and co-author of A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. Jane, I love that you're back with us.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll travel. Let's talk about rolled beef. Apparently on Twitter, someone is singing the praises of something called kosher rolled beef, which I've never heard of. Have you ever heard of that?
I have to say, I've never heard of this rolled beef, but what is it?
I know. So I would love, anyone listening out there, if you could please call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And let us know what the kosher rolled beef is, or you can tweet us. You can go ahead and tweet us at Leonard Lopate or on our show page. But we really want to know what this is. We were just talking about goose pastrami, so maybe people are thinking this is another deli meat.
That's my feeling about it, but I need to know.
So can we just talk about deli for a second?
Let's do deli.
Let's talk. So Katz's is the only one that's still there. But was there, there were so many other delis on the Lower East Side.
It was chock-a-block with delis. I think it was one of these deli-on-every-block situations. And, something that's really interesting about delicatessens is that there was no Jewish delicatessen tradition in Europe. It's something that happened when Jews came to the Lower East Side and saw what Germans were eating in their delicatessens.
Oh, okay.
And adapted that tradition to their own needs, meaning they took out all the non-kosher bits.
Right.
And made it a kosher establishment. So there's a kind of sense that this is something that Jews have been eating forever and ever, and that's absolutely not true. And one thing that I discovered while I was researching the book is that delicatessen was really the food of young people. It was the mothers and the fathers and the grandmothers and grandfathers that felt delicatessen was too fancy.
Oh, interesting.
That they better eat the homemade foods. Delicatessen was for the fancy Americans. So there was a little bit of a generational rift over whether or not we should eat our delicatessen.
And now, of course, it's just so firmly entrenched in,
exactly,
in sort of stereotypical Jewish culture. We need the pastrami. I know I need my tongue sandwich.
Tongue.
That's my favorite. Okay, now I've heard that you can get, a caller from New Jersey just called and said that you can get good bialys at ShopRite in New Jersey today. So that's anybody if wants to. And then Scott called in to recommend Ben's Kosher Deli on West 38th Street. Oh, okay. I don't know this. Do you know Ben's Kosher Deli on West 38th?
Well, it sounds like a garment district place.
And do they have the kosher rolled beef? That's the next question.
That is the question.
Okay, well, let's talk for a minute about the way that immigrant cultures changed the way they ate when they came to, we talked a little bit before about how they preserved their culinary
yes.
food ways, but they also changed the way they ate.
Exactly right.
So deli is one example.
Right.
Can you give us some other examples of how they changed?
Yes, I can, and they changed in all kinds of interesting ways. People are committed to their ancestral foods. But at the same time, we're really curious, and we want to know what the next guy is eating
right.
at the other table. So there was a kind of tug of war between holding on and finding out what else America had to offer. And in a way, I see the evolution of food on the Lower East Side as a story of what happened when old world cooking traditions met new world abundance. And I think what did happen is that there was this kind of fluorescence, this kind of exciting flowering, where people held on to sort of traditional forms, but suddenly had all kinds of new materials to make traditional dishes with. And I think one of the foods that really typifies that sort of that pioneering spirit is the pineapple knish.
Oh.
Which is something that I found in old, in 1930s cookbooks that came out of the Lower East Side. So you see those kinds of foods, these new world foods put into old world recipes. You see cranberry strudels, pineapple knishes. There's all kinds of back and forthing going on. That's one, I think, important way of seeing the food evolution of the Lower
East
Side.
You'd almost call it fusion, actually, in a way.
Yes, you could. You could very well call it fusion. The other thing that, and this is something which is interesting because it happens sort of across the line, not just to Jewish immigrants or just to Italians or Hungarians, but everyone seems to follow this path, is that holiday foods become everyday foods.
Oh, that's interesting. Like, what kinds of things?
Well, at one time, a blintz was something you only ate for the holiday of Shavuot. It was,
really?
You know, a spring holiday, and you ate it when the milk was coming in. And it was a Shavuos food. That connection has been severed.
We don't have the seasonality of the part of the milk anymore.
Yes,
you know?
That's a big part of it, is that we don't have the seasonality. But also, we're so rich now that we can afford to eat a roast chicken on a Wednesday night. That would have been impossible for our grandparents and great-grandparents living on the Lower East Side, who, you know, during the week ate potato and herring, and then when the Sabbath came, they could have
their
chicken.
They also ate a lot more meat in this country than they ate back in Europe.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And that was a sign of how far they had come. Look at us, we're eating meat. It's one funny detail I remember I was reading a history about Italian immigrants on the Lower East Side, and it became a sort of sign of status to walk with a toothpick hanging out of your mouth because it showed that you had some meat caught in your teeth.
You couldn't have just like other things, salad? No, you wouldn't. You had to have a little fishbone in there?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. So we have a caller. Suzanne from Inwood has called us about the rolled beef.
Yes,
so good, she can tell us about it. Suzanne, are you there?
I am here.
Fantastic.
I am here. My aunt and uncle, my late aunt and late uncle, long time ago, used to have a deli in the Bronx. And it was definitely one of the things on their menu, although I don't think they made it. They probably bought it. I don't think they made any of their deli meats. It was, you know how you make porchetta, like you take a piece of meat and you spice it and you roll it up and tie it and then you cook it? That's what rolled beef was. It was spiced. It was rolled up. It was not an expensive cut. Rolled up. I think it was roasted. And then when it got sliced, you could see that it had been rolled and it had some spices. The last time I thought I found it was a couple of years ago at Lesser's on 231st Street in the Bronx. It's like the edge of Riverdale and Kingsbridge. He had it on the menu. I said, wow, I haven't seen it in years. This was like maybe 2 years ago. And I ordered it, and he said, oh, I haven't carried that in years, and I just haven't reprinted my menus in a long time.
I
wish I could tell you where to get it, but it was one of the things that I loved growing up.
That, you know, I think caller five, we have a caller, Harriet from New Jersey, who has had rolled beef recently. Harriet? Can you tell? Yes. Where can we find this mysterious rolled beef?
At Sarge's Deli on the east side on 3rd Avenue.
Oh, they Sarge's.
I am sure they have it because we've had it there in the past year.
Okay.
I'm hailing a taxi.
I know. We're gonna, going to. Jane and I are going out to lunch after the show. But let me ask you one more thing about rolled beef. So it's not cured the way that pastrami is cured, or it is cured? I guess we should have asked that to our last caller. Well, that's another question to put out to our listeners. Was it cured? I mean, because porchetta is cured, I think. Sometimes cured?
I thought it was not cured.
I think porchetta can be cured or not. Anyway, but the question is about rolled beef. Is it cured or is it just spiced and then rolled? I am obsessed with finding rolled beef, as you can tell. So you're going to have to bear with me with this. Let's see. Oh, someone, Danya called up from White Plains to say that in her childhood, they called rolled beef ketchup meat. Interesting.
Ketchup
meat. Because it used some sort of tomatoes. This is Melissa Clark. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Jane Ziegelman, and we're talking about the foods of the Lower East Side. Jane, you did a lot of work with the Tenement Museum, and
yes.
I would love to know, you know, you go into the Tenement Museum, and you look at those kitchens, and they're
yes.
smack in the middle of the apartment, and
right.
they're small. What was it like to cook in a tenement?
It was really hard. And it was hard in different ways at different periods in the history of the building. Initially, when the building went up in the 1860s, it had no running water.
How did people get water?
They went down the stairs with a bucket, and there was a pump in the backyard. They pumped the water, and they hauled it back up.
Wow.
Of course, there was no electricity.
Right.
There were coal-burning stoves, so that was another commodity that had to be brought up and down the stairs.
The coal.
The coal. So just the technology was somewhat primitive, and it took, it was sort of athletic. Cooking was an athletic activity with all of the up and down and the schlepping.
Right, which is
that
why.
Had to take place.
So that you were very fit if you were the family cook, I'm sure.
I do think you were. I mean, these women didn't need to exercise. They were exercising every day. It was part of their lives. It was small. These kitchens are incredibly small. And one of the interesting things about the kitchen is that so many activities take place in a kitchen aside from food. And this was especially true in tenements where space is at such a premium. You can't afford to have a single-use space. So, you know, kitchens at night were bedrooms, but they were also workrooms. They were also where you entertained when the neighbor came down and you wanted to have a glass of tea together. So with all of this activity going on, you were also cooking. Of course, there was no means of refrigeration. So this was another sort of a little stumbling block that women had to work out. And the way they did it, there were two things that they did. One is they would put a box out on the window ledge, mm-hmm. and this was in cold weather, so they would keep foods relatively cool. But in the summer, they sort of had no other option but to go and buy their food meal by meal. So a woman would shop sometimes three times a day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
And were people cooking three times a day, or was it more that you'd cook once a day and then you'd eat, you know, bread, or you'd have buttermilk or something, you know, to fill it out, or were you actually cooking three times a day?
I think in some cases where there were little kids at home, that, yes, mothers were feeding their children three times a day.
We have a lot of people who are lamenting the loss of Ratner's, so maybe we should go. Should we revisit dairy restaurants
sure.
a little bit? Now, are there other dairy restaurants that, I mean, we were talking about that before.
There is one, and I'm just trying to, it's on 3rd Avenue off 8th Street. Is that ringing a bell?
Not for me, but it might for our listeners.
And right now, it's run by Spanish-speaking people. I don't know what country they're from, but it's very interesting because orders are being shouted in Spanish to the kitchen, but the food that comes out is Eastern European Jewish.
Oh, that's so interesting. Oh, wait, I think I know what place you're talking
about. It's a very long, narrow,
and there's a counter.
And there's a counter.
And I'm sure our listeners will call
Someone
up
will
and
know.
Tell us exactly what that, if you need the phone number again, we're at 212-433-9692. Okay, so we have George from Bay Ridge who asks, how has the current change in the Lower East Side neighborhood affected the food? Are there current food trends what are the current food trends, I guess, is the short way to put that.
On the
Lower East Side. And where is it going?
Yeah. Where is it going? Well, I can tell you what I like that's going on the Lower East Side. And it's not so much sort of ethnic, and that's a kind of troubling word, but it's not so much immigrant cooking. It's all kinds of other cooking that sort of come back to the Lower East Side that are sort of more mainstream American. I am predicting that in the next couple of years, we're going to have a pie revival.
Oh, I like the sound
States.
Of that.
I do too. I'm a big pie eater. And recently I had an amazing pie from Petey's Pies on Delancey Street.
Okay.
So one thing I see is pies. There are Well, what where do you go when you eat on the Lower East Side?
You know, I have to say, and I wanted to bring that up. I wanted to talk about the Chinese immigration and Vietnamese right. immigration, because these days I actually will probably go get a bowl of pho. Which is my
absolutely.
Which is one of my favorite. I mean, I love Russ and Daughters, but I often get the appetizing and I bring it home. I less often eat at the cafe, although that's a great place. But yeah, so can we talk for a minute? Oh, people want us to go back to rolled beef, which we're going to do. But let's just for just a second about so Chinese immigrants on the Lower East Side.
Yes.
I mean, at one point, what we consider Chinatown was the Lower East Side. It wasn't a Chinatown. When did that develop? When did we see that wave of immigration?
Well, there was a Chinatown very early in the middle of the 19th century, and
okay.
that was sort of centered around Pell Street. And that kind of stayed in place while the neighborhood changed around it. But then in the 70s and 80s, you had a new wave of Chinese immigrants settling on the Lower East Side, which sort of gave us the modern Chinatown that we know today.
Okay, let's go back to this rolled beef, because we have a butcher who's called in and who can talk us through the process. And this will, I'm sure, answer all of our listeners' questions and our questions as well. Okay. Stephen, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Tell us, how do we do it? About the Lower East Side.
It's very interesting to listen and to tell you that knowing that when people came to this country, obviously efficiency and economy were main in their thoughts of how to get protein into their children and themselves. And the cut that they used to make rolled beef was called dekkel. And dekkel is what you know as short ribs, which have become very much in vogue. Closer to the neck of the animal, along the same place where you would say short ribs, in the neck it's called dekkel. And they would bone out, you'd bone it out, it's very labor intensive to take all the bones out, and then you take as much fat, typically today they take all the fat out, but years ago we'd leave more fat in, you roll it, and then when you roast it, the grease, the fat runs out, as other uses, but nonetheless, you end up with a piece of seasoned meat that is very mild tasting. And so they say lunchbox. It's not, you don't serve it to your company. And, you know, it's the lunchbox for children, although typically fish was more prominent. But oftentimes when you're going to have a piece of beef, and it always was spiced to, you know, different places that spiced it, maybe with more pepper, or some places would actually have it to be almost like with pecan. You would say in the Spanish words, they use
right.
a picante, you know. But nonetheless, it would be always a background. You know, it's something that was always in the reach of people, no matter how difficult the situation was, because it was a piece of meat that really had no other use. Although later, of course, they used it for chopped meat. But one of the things that people miss.
You know, actually, Stephen, I hate to cut you off. We have to run, but I am so happy that you called in. So now we know the dekkel meat was spiced, it was rolled, it was roasted, and then it became a luncheon meat. I could just go on and on talking, but we have to break now. I've been speaking with Jane Ziegelman, director of the I've been speaking with Jane Ziegelman. She's the author of 97 Orchard, An Edible History of Five Immigrant Families in One New York City Tenement, and co-author of A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. Jane, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.